Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We begin with the possibility of a reversal in the vexed relationship between the US and Iran after 34 years of hostility and name-calling, and speak with Gary Sick, who served on the National Security Council under Presidents Ford, Carter, and Reagan, and was the principal White House aide for Iran during the Iranian Revolution and the hostage crisis. He's the author of All Fall Down, America's Tragic Encounter with Iran, and October Surprise, America's Hostages in Iran and the Election of Ronald Reagan. Then we'll look further into the agreement where no one won and no one lost, and where the symbolism outweighs the substance, and speak with anthropologist and Middle East expert William O. Beeman, the author of The Great Satan Versus the Mad Mullahs, How the United States and Iran Demonize Each Other. We will discuss how the hawks on both sides have dominated the narrative up until now, and whether the doves on both sides will be able to establish an enduring dialogue. Then finally, we will look into the second day of protests in Thailand and the special security powers invoked by the government to quell the angry response to a controversial political amnesty bill that would allow the brother of the current prime minister, who was ousted, to return from exile without serving jail time for corruption. Gerald Fry, a distinguished professor of international and intercultural education at the University of Minnesota, who has written extensively about Thailand, joins us to discuss the revival of the bitter divisions that led to a military coup in 2006. Joining us now is Gary Sick, a senior research scholar at Columbia University's Middle East Institute and the author of All Fall Down, America's Tragic Encounter with Iran, and October Surprise, America's Hostages in Iran and the Election of Ronald Reagan. He served on the National Security Council under Presidents Ford, Carter, and Reagan, and was the principal White House aide for Iran during the Iranian Revolution and the hostage crisis. A retired U.S. Navy captain with service in the Persian Gulf, North Africa, and the Mediterranean, he was a deputy director for international affairs at the Ford Foundation from 1982 to 1987, where he was responsible for programs relating to U.S. foreign policy. Welcome to Background Briefing, Gary Sick.
It's nice to be back with you.
And I imagine, since you were there in the White House in charge of the Iran desk at the National Security Council during the hostage crisis, and you have followed this vexed relationship between the U.S. and Iran for these long 34 years of hostility and name-calling, do you think that there may be a reversal in the trajectory of this relationship?
We have seen a truly monumental shift. Somebody said that the U.S. delegation, starting with Secretary Kerry, John Kerry, Secretary of State, and Wendy Sherman and other members of the delegation, had 30 hours of official conversations with senior Iranian officials during this last 2 weeks of whirlwind negotiations. That is 30 hours of direct talks for the first time in 34 years. We had zero conversations at a high level with Iran for all of the intervening periods. We did have some discussions with them during the period of the Afghan invasion, and other things where Iran tried to be helpful to us, and we stiffed them, basically. But basically, this is a real game changer. And in some respects, I think the situation now is really different than it has been before. It is, you know, now suddenly the United States, if it has a problem with Iran, can actually go and talk to Iran and say, we've got a problem, and let's work it out. And they've got somebody on the other end who will say, okay, I hear what you're saying, let's do it this way. And then they negotiate. That is totally new. So my guess is that having crossed that line, having opened up that relationship, it's never going to go back to where it was before. So I do think that we have really move from one era into another. And from the perspective of somebody like me who's been watching it, I can only say it's about time.
And in terms of how quickly things could turn around, you mentioned the possibility that, well, the availability or access now, you can actually talk to somebody on the other side. Now, there's certainly, beyond the nuclear portfolio, which has taken up most of the attention, For example, the U.S. is in a real bind in Afghanistan in terms of getting out, getting all that equipment out. And the Pakistanis have gouged the U.S. and NATO to get the stuff in there in the first place, and now they're trying to gouge them even more to get the stuff out. And the Russians are not being cooperative at all about getting it through the stands. The Iranians have a very, very new highway, which was built with help from India, all the way down from the Persian Gulf right up into Afghanistan. Any chance of that being used, or is that on the agenda?
Well, I can't say what's really on the agenda because I'm not working on Afghanistan and I'm not privy to the internal communications. But it is a very interesting example of the kinds of things that previously would not even be considered and now suddenly are possibilities. I mean, we have, if you start looking at problems around the Middle East, whether it's Afghanistan or Iraq or Syria, or the Arab-Israel dispute, or Lebanon, if you start examining it, Iran is part of that issue. And in many cases, and the point that you make is a good one, we actually have similar interests with Iran, that they want to maintain stability. They are actually prepared to play a constructive role. Not always. And you know, it's not something you can take for granted. On the other hand, having the opportunity to talk to them about their position and explore those mutual interests is a new world. So having an alternative, when the Pakistanis say, you know, no, we're not going to let you do that and we'll charge you X amount or we will make your life very difficult, having an alternative and say, well, okay, we can do it with the Iranians. Suddenly, the bargaining leverage of the United States goes up. And that's true in a number of issues, even in areas where we disagree with them fundamentally. So it's not that we have to love Iran or that they have to love us, but the fact that they are, that we can now deal with them in a sensible way changes everything and actually makes every issue in the Middle East somewhat different. In most cases, somewhat better than it was before. So I do think, I don't want to overestimate this, and I don't want to pretend that everything is just fine, but I do think that we now have opportunities to work on issues together that are actually, once that gets in the mindset of the people in the White House, that's going to be a very attractive idea.
And again, I'm speaking with Gary Sickers, a senior research scholar at Columbia University's Middle East Institute and the author of All Fall Down, America's Tragic Encounter with Iran, and October Surprise, America's Hostages in Iran and the Election of Ronald Reagan. He served on the National Security Council under Presidents Ford, Carter, and Reagan and was the principal White House aide for Iran during the Iranian Revolution and the hostage crisis. So what are we to make then of the naysayers out there with obviously people like former Bush administration ambassador to the United Nations, John Bolton? It's fairly reflexive, saying the deal is badly skewed and an abject surrender by the United States. Israel's prime minister is saying it's not an historic agreement, but an historic mistake. And, I mean, I suspect these are very much in the minority. Most of what I've been hearing has been pretty positive. And one of the things that seems to be missing in most of this criticism, particularly when a lot of Republican senators are saying that the president somehow the Iranians are cooperating with Obama to save him from embarrassment over the launch of Obamacare. It's sort of taking on a surreal kind of nature. But surely it's worth pointing out, this is the P5 plus one. This is not just America's made a deal with Iran. This is the permanent five at the United Nations plus Germany.
Let me make a couple of points here. First of all, just in passing, remember that just 10 days ago, the Israelis touted them as the great victors and you know, as having saved the day because they came in and, in fact, stopped an agreement that would have taken place then, and by being tough. And President Hollande of France went to Israel and was received with a hero's welcome. Well, this last weekend, the French signed off on the agreement. So the agreement that went in has full French agreement and the German. And, you know, British and Russian and Chinese. So this is not an agreement that is sort of casual or is, you know, the United States doing it for narrow political reasons. The other thing that I'd like to point out is that you remember Netanyahu standing up in front of the UN a year ago and holding up that cartoon of a bomb. And the idea of the bomb was that Iran was accumulating 20% enriched uranium. And the red line was when they crossed that line, they would have enough for a bomb. And that the time period would be so short that it possibly would require military action. Well, look at it today. What the Iranians have agreed to in this agreement is basically to remove the entire bomb. It's not up to the red line. It doesn't exist at all. They're doing away with all of their 20% enriched uranium. And frankly, I think it would have been nice if the Prime Minister of Israel would have acknowledged at least that that had been taken care of, that his, you know, his speech to the UN and all of the points that he made there about the threat to Israel had been removed. Now, that doesn't mean that it's a perfect agreement. It doesn't mean that everything has been taken care of. But to turn this agreement around and say that it is a threat to Israel and a threat to the Middle East is really pretty peculiar. When just a year ago you made a speech saying that the great threat to Israel was this body of 20% enriched uranium, which is now going to disappear in the next 6 months. I think there's something really that, you know, we need to get more serious about where we are. It's very clear that the Israelis and the Saudis would very much like for the United States to keep a gun to the head of Assad in Syria, bomb him if necessary, and the same thing with Iran. Keep your force level up very high and threaten them with military action, but don't get an agreement, because the agreement actually reduces the threat and means that the whole thing may be resolved without military action. Well, if that's your criterion, I think it's a false criterion. And basically, the solving these problems, whether it's the chemical weapons in Syria or the nuclear weapons, the potential of a nuclear bomb in Iran, is very much in the U.S. interest. And I think that Obama's program, his policy on the Middle East, is really to say, we are prepared to do what's necessary to preserve U.S. national interests. And he doesn't say anything in that policy that we're going to go around and threaten, you know, war with other countries on behalf of other countries. And basically, he's looking at U.S. national interests in a very clear and unequivocal way. And I think that's refreshing and actually, I think, should be applauded. So from my perspective, what he's doing is actually serving American national interests extremely well. And that, I think, needs to be pointed out.
And Gary Sick, the French objection to the deal that almost happened and now has happened had a lot to do, my understanding is it had a lot to do with the Arak reactor, which is a heavy water reactor that produces lots of plutonium in the spent fuel. But one of the things that's been missing in the debate is that while the Iranians have agreed to freeze that construction, and my understanding, the subtext was that there was a fear that the Israelis would strike that. That was like the number one on the hit list, and they'd have to do it before it went hot. But my understanding is that the Iranians have no reprocessing of the spent fuel rods, which is a very complicated process. They have no infrastructure for it. So the idea, and you know, one could be definitely justifiably concerned that the Iranians are building a reactor that's identical to the Dimona reactor that produced all of the plutonium for Israel's bombs. But the Israelis have the reprocessing of the fuel rods to extract the plutonium. There's no evidence that Iran has that. So
not only do they not have it, but in this agreement that has just been signed, they formally agree not to build a reprocessing plant. So their argument is they want to use that heavy water reactor to produce isotopes, which are used for medical purposes. That's their argument. The reality is the reactor that they now use to do that is a reactor that the United States gave them back in the old days under the Shah, and which they have been using for medical isotopes, but it's very outdated. And it was actually to keep that one running that they were producing the 20% enriched uranium. So this is all a very circular business. The key problem on all of this, Ian, and what really makes it difficult, is that anything that you do for a peaceful nuclear program actually can have consequences, can actually create the possibility of a military capability. So it is almost impossible to draw a line between those two. And so if you look at a country, and this could be any number of countries, it certainly could be Japan, it could certainly be Brazil or Argentina or other countries who are producing uranium on their own, enriched uranium, basically going about a nuclear program of nuclear development and energy, those same things that they're doing could be used for military purposes. And so in the Iranian case, everything that they do, regardless of what the objective is interpreted as a covert effort to create a bomb. And what the negotiations are about is how do you ensure that those activities that Iran is doing do not turn into a bomb. And right now, we are seeing a case where Iran is actually cooperating with us on that. They're saying, okay, we don't want to build a bomb, and we're prepared to give real assurances, including daily inspections and lots of other intrusive inspections. Iran is the most inspected country in the entire world as far as their nuclear program is concerned. So Iran is saying, we're prepared to cooperate on that. And so I have a hard time understanding the sort of hysteria that says, okay, there's something that they're doing over here that could conceivably in some future state turn into a nuclear weapon. Well, the way to deal with that is through negotiation and say, okay, there's reason to be suspicious about this. Let's give us assurances so that we inspect this as necessary. And in the case of the heavy water reactor, there's no reprocessing. So you cannot build a bomb with that reactor. That's the way to deal with the problem. And the idea that you have to, in effect, eradicate Iran's nuclear program in order to solve the problem is really a recipe for war. It's a recipe that the only way the problem can be resolved is through military action. And that is a very expensive, complicated, and ultimately self-defeating process.
Well, just in closing then, Gary Sick, some people have compared this to Nixon's opening with China. And of course, it's worth remembering that Nixon's opening with China had an awful lot to do with Russia and to triangulate, put the U.S. in the catbird seat, being able to play China off against Russia. Is there any possibility that this deal could put us in the catbird seat in terms of playing off Saudi Arabia? We're reducing our dependence on Middle East oil, but we do have this very, very duplicitous relationship with Saudi Arabia. And, you know, they're behind the radicals in Syria. I can go through the whole list of the Taliban, yeah. Al-Qaeda, you name it. Is there a possibility that there's any broader geopolitical consequences here?
Well, I think when you hear the cries of anguish from Saudi Arabia and also from Israel, part of it is that they're concerned about, they would like to have Iran stay as an enemy behind, you know, a wall and isolated and under the gun. And they don't want to deal with Iran as another, you know, legitimate country in the Middle East. And I think that's really what's going on here, is that because of this opening, because of the discussions that we've had and the negotiation, Iran is now able to play a more normal role in the Middle East. And that does bother some people. With regard to U.S. interests in particular, I think what it does is it reduces the threat in the Middle East overall. So, for instance, after this negotiation, the price of oil went down by 2% just over the weekend. That's money in people's pockets. That's basically, it's good for our economy, actually, and for normal drivers. So there are benefits to be gained from this. And the other one is that the United States, over the last 10 years, has created an extremely extensive array of bases and operating facilities in the Middle East and military forces that are quite expensive. And if the threat level goes down because Iran becomes a more normal country or is dealt with through diplomacy rather than military threats, it means that the cost to the American taxpayer goes down. And that's also a net plus. So there are some real advantages involved in this in terms of U.S. national interests. I must say that a lot of the people who are most offended by this agreement and who are most unhappy about it are very much the same people who really wanted to get us into Iraq and who have been cheerleaders for the Iraq war and all of the costs and everything else that went with that. And I think that needs to be pointed out. I mean, we are avoiding a war by doing a deal with Iran. And indeed, that makes some people unhappy. But I think if you have to make people unhappy, that's the way to do it.
Well, Gary Sick, I thank you so much for joining us.
A pleasure.
Again, I've been speaking with Gary Sick, who's a senior research scholar at Columbia University's Middle East Institute and the author of All Fall Down, America's Tragic Encounter with Iran, and October Surprise, America's Hostages in Iran and the Election of Ronald Reagan. He served on the National Security Council under Presidents Ford, Carter, and Reagan and was the principal White House aide for Iran during the Iranian Revolution and the hostage crisis. And we're going to take a brief station break and we'll look further into the agreement in which symbolism outweighs substance.